So, Bruce, how are you today?
Yeah, good, thanks, Will. It's, as you know, the Mother's Day weekend, so it's been an interesting time, probably across the whole globe. It's one of the few dates that I think nearly every country shares. So,
and I didn't even know that. I didn't know that mothers were celebrated in Australia on the same day as in the US. It's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing. Fathers aren't, though. So maybe we could say there's some gender issue here that
there you go.
For some reason, fathers are celebrated on different days, but mothers are all celebrated on the same one.
We're treated very poorly. That's too bad. So anyway, welcome everyone to another podcast, another Modern Learners podcast. And Bruce, we have a little bit of a celebration tonight. We are actually hitting a milestone this week for our work together. And it's kind of exciting.
It
and
sure
we're
going
to riff a little bit off on that. But I'll let you tell everyone what the big news is for our work together.
Well, it's...
If you remember, do you remember?
Been that long. We're about to hit our 200th issue of Modern Learners News.
200 newsletters. How about that?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I never, you know, when we started this conversation in a car ride heading to the airport about 4 years ago, it wasn't quite about just doing a newsletter, but it certainly has evolved from there. But the one thing that has stuck is that newsletter. And so this week is going to be issue number 200. And what that also means is somewhere close to 200 blog posts in our Modern Learners account, because for every newsletter, we do a Shifting Conversations essay post. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to pick a few of our favorites, and we're just going to see how things are in terms of whether or not they're still relevant, how things have changed, and just reflect a little bit on the last few years of doing this, which has been really good work, I have to say. I mean, I think that trying to, you know, kind of almost be being forced to write a couple times a month along the lines of what we, you know, the work that we're doing, I think is an exercise in just thinking hard about the world and sharing those ideas with people. It's been really good.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think it's, I think what's been great is the feedback that we've got over the time. I mean, people have stuck with us. It seems like we must be talking about stuff that people find information that people find useful, because our readership's been growing fairly significantly. And I know a lot of people open the newsletter each week. So that certainly inspires us to put more time into what we're doing. And I know in addition to the posts, you know, we keep trying to curate links and articles that people have put together in other places, so that people who are reading our newsletter can stay well informed and make ultimately better decisions on behalf of the kids that are in their charge. So it's been a lot of fun, and as you said, it helps us keep focused. So maybe I can kick this off, because I think as we're putting together this collection, probably one of the most powerful headlines was one that you put in one not too long ago, and you said, are you powerless? And I know that's a topic that came from a workshop that you were running, actually, I think down here in Australia. Interested in what you were thinking at that time and why you felt that this was a topic you needed to write more about.
Well, I think the reason that I wrote about it was because I'd heard it on a number of occasions in a fairly short period of time, and talking to primarily classroom teachers who are, I think, still mostly open to the argument that we need to do things differently in our practice, yep. But who then look at the barriers and just kind of shake their heads and say, I just don't know how I can do this, because... Yeah. There are these state tests that our kids have to pass. My livelihood is now based on that. And, you know, I don't have the leadership to do it. There's no vision or whatever. And I literally had a couple people tell me, you know, they felt totally powerless to change. And I tried to, in that post, just kind of push back on that a little bit, you know, by saying that, sure, the barriers are really high. There's no question about that. But that there are always things that we can do to make the learning experience different and more relevant for kids in classrooms. And at the very least, we can start with ourselves, that while we may be realistically somewhat powerless to make big changes happen in our classrooms for kids, what about our own practice? What about the way that we interact with the world? What about the way that we learn with technology? What about the way that we're connected and sharing and modeling the types of learning environments that are now available to our kids? And that as much as it may be really difficult to do in classrooms, which I totally understand, that we almost have a professional responsibility these
obligation.
Days.
Yeah.
Obligation to be learning in these new kind of contexts that we talk about all the time. So I get it that this is really hard and it's still really hard. I'm not sure. I think I wrote that post two years ago or so, and I'm not sure that I am sure that there are still lots of people who feel powerless when it comes to change like that. But I think it's more important now than ever, as things seem to get even more complex, that we take that kind of challenge on for ourselves at least, and find ways that in our own learning practice, our personal learning practice, that we can become
more
connected and using the tools, creating in the ways we want kids to.
Yeah, I take your point on that, but I'm wondering, when you raised that issue of complexity, and in the article you also talked about this time of change being overwhelming, is powerlessness almost like a knee-jerk first response to both those issues? Are people really saying, not that I'm powerless because of, tests or curriculum compliance or whatever else, but are they powerless at what's going on around them, rather than in the world around them, rather than, state standards and whatever else? I worry that that's really what's causing their sense of powerlessness, rather than what they're being told to teach, as an example.
I don't disagree with that. I think, and I do think this feeling of powerlessness is kind of a, like you said, a knee jerk or a first reaction to dealing with how much things have changed and how overwhelming it gets. And I mean, look, I look at the world today in lots of ways and I feel powerless about lots of things.
Yeah.
But I don't feel powerless around how I learn. And I think that's the point, right?
Yeah.
Is that, North Korea fired another test missile today, and there's a whole bunch of people hacking into computers around the world. And in many cases, when, in the aggregate, I look at all that and I go, what do I do about that? I mean, how do I deal with that?
Yeah.
There's not much I can do, but when it comes down to thinking about what's possible in terms of the use of technology, both in and out of the classroom, I'm not powerless to do that work on my own. Most of the teachers and most of the educators who express that do have access. So it's not a question of not having the technology. It's just a question of figuring out how to use that technology in interesting ways and in ways that amplify learning. So I agree with you. I think that it's a very difficult, and it's a huge shift and change. It's difficult for people to wrap their brains around that. But I think at the end of the day, we have to be able to package that into our own personal practice and ask ourselves, are we really powerless to change ourselves?
That's
where we have to start.
That's a really good point, because I was just thinking as you were saying that, I was wondering whether the contradiction is our empowerment making people feel powerless? Is the fact that people now can connect to all those things, is that exposing the complexity in the world around them, and are they overwhelmed by that? And is that what's making them feel powerless? And I think if that's the case, I think if people become aware of that, then maybe they can do something about it, because it is in their control. When people behave as if they're powerless, it's because they're saying it's not in their control. And as you said, you're in control of your own learning.
Yeah. So now I get to pick your brain a little bit about a post that you wrote. And you are interesting in a lot of, for a lot of reasons, but one of the, I think, most interesting things about your experience is that you were there at the first one-to-one laptop installation at Melbourne Ladies College. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Back now, what, 27 years ago, something like that, believe that or not, that over a quarter century ago, there were students walking around in school, all of them with laptops, which is a pretty interesting thing.
Yeah.
So you wrote a post called Road to Nowhere, which, you know, were kind of your reflections on what that all looked like. And that you have a quote in there that you said, you know, ironically, the laptop was in effect both a blessing and a curse. I wonder how you feel now. I mean, I know it's only been a couple of years removed from when you wrote this, but are you sensing anything different about that kind of road in terms of the use of technology in classrooms and it being a blessing or a curse? Are we changing in that respect at all with this stuff?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Will. It is interesting. It's interesting when you reflect back on things and, you know, you don't want to get sentimental or you know, too reflective about this because you've got to move on. And my sense about it is actually, I think people are now acknowledging just that. I actually think that when I wrote that, I think there was still a bit of pizzazz about the shiny new objects. And I think we were coming out of the back end of the absurd sort of deployments in Los Angeles with, you know, 640,000 kids, many of them in very challenged economic circumstances, having over $1 billion spent on them, on shiny new objects called, you know, iPads or whatever they were. And
yeah, that wasn't a blessing, was it?
And basically,
that was definitely a curse.
And it was a curse. But think about why it was a curse, because it's a curse, number one, because there goes $1 point something billion in an education budget just pushed down the toilet. Number two, how many people became completely disillusioned about what technology could do for kids? Number three, how many had their potential, you know, the economic opportunities that they may have been afforded by becoming, you know, getting access to the world around them through those devices was taken away from them because the whole thing was done, and we're certainly not going to go through the details here, but for all the wrong reasons in all the worst ways. And yet it didn't need to come to this and it didn't need to be there. And I know you and I talk so frequently about the wisdom and insights of Seymour Papert, but I think we also say what really scares us is the extent to which he foresaw all this and that, you know, he did have at times a somewhat cynical and questioning view about just how the institution of school would adapt and adopt new technologies. And sadly, you know, he was 100% right. And so in answer to your question, the shift I see, though, is in the last 2 years since I wrote that, I think firstly, now there's wide acknowledgement of the downsides of this. I think people have moved. I get a sense that many people have moved on from the device, from the technology, and the focus is on learning. I think that there is a new era of people looking at the ed part of ed tech and realizing that's the only part that really matters. And I think that maturity in the way that we're now thinking about how we use technology in schools is inspiring. And hopefully that's can be the direction we take from here.
So one-to-one, I think for you has always meant laptops. Are we beyond that in schools? Because I know that a lot of places now see one-to-one as devices. So where's your head in terms of the one, and you know, in terms of the technology one? Is it just giving kids access, or is it a laptop still for you?
That's a good question, because yeah, you're right. I've certainly ridden the laptop piece of that one. Ridden that horse as hard as you could. I always used to say it had to be a personal, portable, you know, device, the fully functional device, and I always put fully functional on it. And I think, as you know, but for everyone listening to this podcast, the rider of laptop was only, and I know that our colleague Gary Steger feels very strongly about this too, was that that vendors, and it was really a vendor-driven thing, but sometimes it was done by educational leaders, always wanted to dumb the device down. It was like, okay, so we know there's this thing called fully functional laptops that, that corporations use and the business people use, but kids don't really need that much power, so we'll give them a dumbed-down device. And dare I say it, the first generation of those were PDAs. Then people have probably forgotten about personal digital assistants. But there was tens of millions of dollars spent on these stupid things because everyone thought, well, kids don't need to have the power of a personal computer in their hands. And they do.
Right.
And as you and I both know, kids are power users, not just on video games. But these are the kids that really do require this in their hands. So the answer to your question is, from my point of view, is no compromise in that let's empower kids with exactly the same tools that we think that adults and people in corporations and businesses has used. And, but let's at least, you know, recognize that, that we've got to be careful that if we do look for alternative devices to, for instance, a laptop, that we make sure that kids have access to whatever they will need to express themselves in whatever form they want to, that they're not limited by the device. That means let's not give them a dumbed down operating system. Let's not give them dumbed down functionality. Let's not take away their ability to connect and collaborate. And you and I both know that, and I'll, you know, I mean, we'll share some, you know, significant brands, but I mean, you know, when Apple came out with the iPad, the last thing they thought that it was going to be the ultimate student device, because it isn't. It's a fantastic device. It's unbelievable. It sold, you know, tens, probably hundreds of millions of the things. But to think it was going to be a fully functional replacement for what kids were doing with laptops was just unrealistic. As a complementary, supplementary device, fantastic, brilliant. And I think the long answer to your question is that there are alternatives to a child just having access to their own laptop, because today they can obviously have a number of devices that give them the full functionality that they once had in one device. And if they have that, I think that's fine. But let's not compromise any of this for kids at any point in time.
So we can save this for another day, but you know, there is the, you know, Chromebook question in terms of the fully functioning device. And, you know, just with the context that the big news in the New York Times Magazine this week is, you know, Google's pretty much taken over now in schools and classrooms, and the consequences of that, because I think it does limit the, the functionality. It does set a lower bar, let's say, than is possible with a fully functioning laptop. And, you know, seriously, we could spend, and maybe we should spend a full, you know, hour, 45 minutes just talking about that. Probably not tonight, but yeah, so it is interesting.
I, you know, you heard, I think possibly the listeners heard the exasperation that came out of my mouth as you mentioned it.
I was loath to even mention it. In the interest of time.
Just let me share this, that to think that for all the energy and the millions of hours of time and effort that people and put into to enabling this for kids and for the wisdom of people like Papert and so many others, to think that what ended up, you know, really scaling kids' access to a device was online testing, which was enabled more cheaply and easily using something like a Chromebook, is the tragedy of the whole circumstance. I cannot believe that in the end it was online testing, and sadly under Obama, 18 months ago, that really was the sort of explosion of it. And I just wish that if people can somehow justify having a less functional device like a Chromebook to do what they need to do for things other than online testing, supplemented by other devices, fantastic. But please, 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 can we not in any way believe the whole point of this exercise was to provide kids with the ability to have efficient online tests delivered to them? Because that wasn't really the point of it all.
So on that optimistic note.
I'm going to use that as a segue into an article that you wrote a little while ago when you said everything you think is disruptive isn't. And I think it does a nice segue out of a device discussion into a slightly broader spectrum of technology options. And in that, you obviously, amongst others, highlighted the faddism of MOOCs, and a couple of other people who were writing at that time talked about this new online environment. I'm interested what your thoughts are about it at this time.
Well, the irony, not the irony, but the interesting thing is that I just had, and I'm not going to be able to find it right now, but I just had another article that came up yesterday that I tweeted out, something that said that artificial intelligence is going to change everything. I don't. Did you see that? I think. Oh. But and I said something on the tweet, something like, "That's the most craptastic post I've seen in a long time in terms of it saying this is it, you know, it's gonna change."
Just two words: Second Life.
There we go. And virtual reality. Yeah, that's the other one too, right? So those are the two new ones. Look, I think that, you know, we have again this tendency of overreacting when new technologies hit the web or hit our inbox or whatever. And we start fooling around with them and we think that they're going to just totally change everything that we do. And there's no question that technologies have had a huge effect on how we do things and our ability to, you know, as I've said before, amplify the way that we learn and the way that our kids learn. But that's the problem, is that we don't start with that learning piece. And the irony of all that is that while the technologies can be quote unquote disruptive, you know, and we're going back to Clay Christensen and, you know, all that disrupting class and everything else, right? I think probably the most disruptive thing that we can do right now is define what we mean by learning, right? Which has nothing to do with technology. Yeah. And it's, you know, and that's the most disruptive thing to our practice, because what we sometimes have to be reminded of, and, you know, again, we say this all the time, we've talked about this a lot, but sometimes we have to be reminded about the fact that what we do in schools really doesn't reflect what we believe about how kids learn, how anybody learns. And that's the real disruption. So, you know, this goes back to, again, another post that I wrote a couple weeks ago, actually, about learning's really kind of crappy adoption curve, where, you know, I was just talking about this idea that, you know, they were talking about technologies that have quick adoption curves are the ones that are kind of just plug and play. So you can take for instance, a refrigerator and plug it in because the socket was already there. But if you want a washing machine, you got to add plumbing, plumbing, and you got to do all this other stuff, right? And it's the same with the technologies that we use. You know, Chromebooks, really, to our earlier discussion, don't really change anything. No. I mean, they're disruptive in that they
use power,
get rid of books, and textbooks now are digital, perhaps, and now we can hold it, hand in homework, and we can go paperless and efficient. Those types of things.
Efficient.
Efficient. But that's not really disruptive in the sense that it moves agency over to kids around their learning, because we know that learning requires passion and real purposes and all that kind of stuff. So I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, we use that term and we think that it's about the technology. It's not. It's about the learning. And that's where we really don't want to. We'd much rather layer bunches of technology on top of what we currently do than get to a fundamental reimagination and rethink about our practice that's based on what we believe about how kids learn. So there's a huge sense of irony in that. And the other piece of it is, you know, blended learning is disruptive and flipped learning is disruptive and competency-based learning is disruptive and blank learning is, you know, disruptive. And it just, It just doesn't, child-centered learning, learner-centered learning is my favorite now, right? I've gotten personalized learning still makes me shake a little bit, but now I love that one, learner-centered learning. I mean, it just boggles the mind that someone would think that that's disruptive.
There's every chance that someone's going to be at ISTE in San Antonio.
Absolutely.
Big flashing neon sign.
Absolutely.
Learning-centered learning.
Student-centered learning. It's crazy. What else would it be?
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, but I mean, you were saying that it's interesting that just to throw back where you started, I just tracked it down as we were talking, and it was Roy Amara from Institute of the Future who said we tend to overestimate new technologies in the near term and underestimate their impact in the long term. And I'm like you, sick and tired of this faddism and sort of get on the latest hobby horse. When the truth is, as you said, that, you know, unfortunately, what we've been doing in schools has been disrupting learning for too long. And that's the piece we've got to focus on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so it goes back to, you know, my favorite game, which is this game of redefinition. This game of language, which I just find so totally fascinating. I always have found language really interesting, but in an education technology and learning schooling sense, just amazing the stuff that we say that we don't really even hear or think about at any real deep level. We just hear these phrases and they go, oh yeah, that sounds great. Let's use that.
Learning-centered learning.
It's crazy. So let me use that then as a segue into another one of your pieces, which you wrote one called Beyond Better, which was basically this idea of, talked a lot about this idea of incrementalism.
Yeah.
So, you know, which I think fits with this conversation we just had, because I think a lot of it is about just, you know, not doing too much different.
Yeah.
And getting back to this, I don't think you used it, but to this Russell Acuff quote about, you know, doing the right thing wrong, or doing the wrong thing right, I'm sorry, right? And, you know, and you said in that post, you had this quote where it said, it's no wonder that we're seeing more and more workshops focusing on the essential sub-skills of teaching and the factors that have the most influence on students' learning experience. So talk about that a little bit. Do you think we're still in this era of incrementalism in schools, or are you seeing any places where transformation with a capital T is happening and we're just changing the whole thing fairly
quickly? Well, I know you and I would answer the last part of that question by saying, celebrating the answer being yes, because that's what change
has
been about. And that's what, frankly, the last 7 or 8 weeks has been some of the most rewarding professionally for both of us, because the phenomenal opportunity to work with some people who are doing that capital T transformation. So that's the great news. And I think both of us also know that the whole purpose of putting Change School together was to draw those people together, to take away any sense they had of isolation, that they were the only people who were doing this in the world, and have built a community together. And I think we're both just overwhelmed by how that's gone. But back to the original question, it's intriguing when you just overlap those two quotes of Russell Acuff, and the original quote came out of one that I can say I actually shared in a personal conversation with Seymour Papert, and it was about, and I've used it in hundreds of workshops across the globe, when he said, why is there so, his exact quote is something like, why is there so little discussion about whether people see the need to move incrementally or as a fundamental shift in their practice? And the question isn't so much which is right, but why is there so little discussion about it, which is what we're doing today.
Right.
And when I do that, I always then put a continuum. I put a scale up on the whiteboard, on the screen or whatever. You know, 1 to 5, where do you sit? Are you an incremental changer? Are you a fundamental shifter? And without trying to trivialize that question, of course, you could then spend an hour or more the day talking about what you mean by incrementalism and by fundamental shift and all that sort of thing. Transformation. I mean, it's really incrementalism or transformation. And no matter which way you look at it, incrementalism wins. I mean, it's unfortunate that people really are acknowledging their own mind, that there needs to be change, and that even there needs to be significant change. But in so many cases, they can only make that change in baby steps. And And by the way, this is not to say that there isn't a space for that that strategy at times. At times, that's absolutely what you, what you're going to do. But ultimately, you've got to be ready to do the big jump. You can't continue, you know, this sort of conflict we have in our minds of somehow we're going to eventually get schools to where they need to be aligned with the context of the modern world, and we're going to get there by some incremental shifts when the modern world isn't going through incremental shifts. Right. That's the conflict right. we're facing. And so my final sort of comment about that is that the best example I can often think of, Will, when we talk about it, and you've heard me say this, is just to be really concrete and say, let's talk about mathematics, you know, and think about how we think about the teaching of mathematics. And my question just becomes, how should we teach mathematics in a digitally rich world? If all kids have access to these powerful devices and can do so much, like extraordinary amount of work on them, why do we continue to teach paper and pencil mathematics? And you know, I'm quoting Conrad Wolfram in yeah. that. Right. But surely, if there's an opportunity for a fundamental shift, it has to be just in one space. There's an idea. Why don't we take it?
So you mentioned the work that we've been doing at in Change School. For those of you who are listening who may not know about that work, we're at change.school. That's the web address, and it's this first iteration of what we have both come to the conclusion is some pretty interesting work about how to move, or how to really get your brain wrapped around a process for moving beyond better. Yeah. So Bruce, let me just ask you, I mean, because we go through 8 different modules in that, but if yeah. there was one of those modules, just for the sake of time, that you think is most important for getting past better to different, which one of those would it be? I mean, which aspect of the change process do you think is most effective in getting us past incrementalism into something that's serious change?
It's interesting. It's a good question, because I think we've both found the discussions we've had with the people who've been with us in that community to be enlightening across the whole spectrum of all the modules. But I do think it's that space when people see that they need to align their beliefs with practice. I think that's the piece that, to me, is where that's the bigger heart with people. I mean, I know you in your workshops, you often say, you know, you spend a lot of time talking to people about their beliefs around learning and have them share their ideas. But then when you sort of, you're questioning, you say, and this is back to the Acuff quote, you know, why do we, if we know that's the right thing, if we know that we know our beliefs around learning are the right thing, then why do we continue to practice the wrong thing and try and improve our wrong practice, our practice around that thing? You know, why is it that we just don't seem to be able to align our practice with our beliefs? And I think I've noticed, and that's about, by the time we get to about the third week, I think was where I could see that, you know, you could see it in the discussions. We had these Zoom sessions, which I think people listening on our podcast may or may not be familiar, but they're basically a video cast with everyone online and on screen. And you can almost see the penny drop with people. And they're saying, you know what, as long as I continue to have, you know, my practice not aligned with my beliefs, I'm not going to get anywhere. And sure, I can do a, you know, improve practice that's not in line with my beliefs, and that's a very poor effort. That's incrementalism at its worst. But it's when people all of a sudden say, you know what, I really have to rethink what I'm doing, because in my head I know one thing, and in my practice I see another, and that just can't continue. And I think you'd agree that's the space that I think is the bigger heart for most people.
I do agree, and I think that that is where it all starts for me. If we're not articulating what we believe about how kids learn, if we're not clear on that first, and if we're not then honoring that, it's going to be incrementalism, because it's going to be in the pursuit of something that, as Acuff says, at the end of the day, as hard as it is to phrase it like this, but it's the wrong thing. So yeah, I would agree with that.
And
so just one more round here, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say to you, I have to also say though, that wouldn't you agree, the other part that I think I found really, it was actually exciting to hear people telling the new story. So if we talk about these things, and we talk about these as the learning professionals in something like Change School, that's all very cute, but how do we share those ideas?
Mm-hmm.
Not only how do we share those ideas with faculty, with staff, with students, but most importantly with parents, because despite what I think some people may be thinking who are listening to this podcast, there is a lot of concern out there now across the community that people, I mean, it's the world they're living in that's shifting, this modern world, the modern context. And they know that in their heart of hearts, whilst they might have thought that school should be what it was for them, for their kids, they know that things have to change. And so I think the discussions we had over a week around telling the new story were some of the most powerful that we've seen.
And I do agree that somewhat of an irony that if you don't know what it looks like,
yeah,
if you don't know what it looks like when your beliefs align with your practice, then, you know, it's hard to transform, because you don't have the capacity to really understand what that means.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. One more round. So what do you got for me, Bruce? Last one. And then I got one more for you, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay.
Because we have to go out and start. We have to go out and, you know, pop that champagne, you know, for the 200th newsletter. You know,
but
we have to start partying.
It's a week of celebrations. It's a week.
It's week long. Week long. Yes.
Yeah, and we might call it tonight. This is now Modern Learners Week.
That's right.
I hope we get a big cake and lots of special bottles of champagne. So you've said in an article that we titled "What We Know Isn't What We Do," and it's building on what we were just talking about. And so I just wanted to reinforce it, because, you know, I know you talk a lot about this, but your quote in here, and I'll read it, is "Our problem in education is, however, we don't do what we know. By and large, our classrooms aren't about giving students the opportunity to pursue questions that interest them, real world outcomes and personal choices in how they move through the learning process. Why?"
Well, look, I mean, I think that that's the biggest question that we have to grapple with right now.
Yeah.
Because I really have come to the belief, and this is based on being a parent of two kids, who my last kid, my young son, is going to graduate next month. So that's going to be 24 combined years of education, watching my kids have 24 combined years of education. And just over the last 5 or 6 years, after meeting people like Gary Stager and Sylvia Martinez and you and many others, having these much deeper level conversations around what learning is, and really trying to frame what my beliefs are. I mean, it took me until, 7-8 years ago before I really started thinking deeply about, well, what is learning? And then just reflecting on myself as a learner over the time that I've been online and connected and, you know, doing this work as well. I mean, the intersection of those three things has just led me to this belief that we absolutely have to change it, and that it's kind of interesting, I guess, is the word to me, that we haven't. I find it still fascinating that the argument is so compelling, and it's also almost a moral argument at this point.
No, I think it is a moral argument.
I think it always has been, but it's more acute right now because of the way the world has changed.
Yeah.
That why aren't we doing this? Why are we not changing in ways that in our heart of hearts, we know we need to, you know?
Okay, can I go one step further? Can we say it's negligent not to do that?
Yeah. It's malpractice.
Yep.
How's that?
Yep.
Right. I mean, if we were lawyers, if we were physicians, if we were just about any other professional, let's be honest.
Yep.
Be brought up on charges, I think, you know, because if we went to a doctor and a doctor said, I believe that this would be the best treatment for you, but I'm going to do this instead.
That's right.
We'd be like, wait, what? Or, you know, if a lawyer said, well, here's the best defense that I can give you, but I'm going to go in this direction instead because it's more, you know, it's more expected.
It's aligned with my current practice. And
it's crazy. It's crazy. And so, you know, and I hesitate a little bit to use that word because I know that most people will hear that and say, well, he's saying that we're unprofessional, or he's saying that I'm not worthy, or he's, and I've had a lot of people say that to me, that when they hear, you know, the way that construct is, you know, put together when it comes to teaching and learning, that it's an attack on the profession. Yeah, it is kinda, but I get to a certain extent why we're there with it. I give people, I mean, license, and I understand why the profession is where it's at to a certain extent. But at some point, you gotta wake up and kind of go, I can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
I can't keep doing this the way that I'm doing it. I mean, I look at what my kids experienced in school. They had lovely people for the most part as their teachers, but they didn't learn much. And they didn't really learn a lot about how to live in the world and to think in the world and to create in the world in ways that were meaningful to them, because their teachers were unable or reluctant or whatever to do what they believe about good learning. I mean, they practiced schooling. They practiced and taught an education. And I get, you know, it goes back to the beginning in terms of powerlessness and all that kind of stuff. But
do you think, I wonder whether, you know, because people do react when we talk like this and everyone thinks, well, you know, you're attacking teachers and not, but we're not saying that at all. And as you said, these people are great people but people are, it's habit, it's inherited practice, it's tradition. And I worry, probably the word that maybe people can accept, and I think it probably describes it reasonably well, is maybe just complacency. It's sort of convenient. You know, I've been doing this and this is the way it's been. And I don't really need to challenge this because, you know, I've been successful in my practice in the past. Whereas you and I both know that the people we've been working with in Change School and the teachers in those schools, you know, these are people who wake up every morning and say, you know, I can do better. I can do this in ways that are aligned with my practice. And it is inspiring and exciting and challenging and all those things that every learning professional must yearn for.
I agree with you, but we would never allow our physician to be complacent.
Tell me about that.
We just wouldn't.
Nope.
You know, if a loved one is being treated for a you know, cancer, my doctor's just complacent. I mean, it's just, you know, not much I can do about that. You know, yeah. I just think it's, you know, it is, but we don't talk about teaching in that respect. We don't talk about teaching in the context of life or death, you know, and
being the learning professionals. We don't think of ourselves as that.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so let me just segue out of that one before I get in too much trouble into the final little conversation we're going to have here, which is segues perfectly into this, which is a post that you wrote called The Mystery of Pedagogy, which basically asked the question, you know, what if current practice is simply outdated? I mean, what if now we just, you know, have to wake up and kind of go, yeah, this just is not what we're supposed to be doing any longer. And just to read one little quote from this, you ask, well, how well do existing pedagogies serve the needs of modern learners? While in some circumstances this might be understandable, nonetheless, it would seem reasonable to suggest that we need to be more attentive to the empowerment that pedagogy offers the profession, because after all, it is our practice. So what do you think, Bruce? I mean, is this the moment? I mean, have we arrived at the moment now where pedagogy and past practice is going to be kind of, you know, called out, and we're finally going to look at it and say, or are we beginning to look at it and say, yeah, you know what, this just is not working any longer. And if you think that's where we are, how long is it going to take before that really, you know, takes hold and makes an impact in schools?
Well, as you say about each of these topics, there's a lot we could talk about, but I've always been sort of challenged by this notion that people are so precious about their current practice, and a lot of our collective current practice is neither based on beliefs or anything, but literally tradition, and it just doesn't make sense for all the reasons that you just mentioned. A couple of examples to be specific. I've always loved that word, and I don't even know whether people believe it's an accurate definition, but I love the notion that, you know, pedagogy is the art and science of teaching and learning. And I don't care whether people think that's an accurate description or not, because to me, it gives me a freedom as a learning professional to go about my craft in the best possible way that I can, that's aligned with my beliefs. And I do believe, and we've talked about this before, I think both of us have had some very fortunate experiences with people we've been exposed to, books we've read, people who have influenced our thinking. And I certainly always feel, I'm very precious about a lot of the ideas that I've come across in the past that I think have been hidden, tucked away, that people have ignored around pedagogy. And I'm embarrassed that even a number of people in the profession do not like even using that term. And yet as learning professionals, surely we should be inspired by the fact that there is some science and there is some creativity associated with our craft. Because sure as heck, when I was teaching, that's what I loved about it. You know, there were certain things that I knew that if I followed a certain process, that I could yield certain results in the work that I was doing with kids. And I don't mean test results by any means, but I also knew that I had the freedom to be creative in that environment and to draw on, you know, the side of you that inspires you to get up in the morning and walk into a classroom. And so I don't know why we would be threatened or overwhelmed or intimidated by the notion of new pedagogy. I mean, we both know that Michael Fullan and others are doing a big project called, New Pedagogies for Deeper Learning. And I wish them well. I hope that project's going extremely well for them. But I lament the fact that people seem to find this notion of using these ridiculously powerful tools to help us enable more opportunities for more kids to learn in deeper ways, in any way overwhelming or intimidating. It has to be inspiring. And as a teacher, as a learning professional, therefore, you know, we have to sit down and challenge everything we're doing. I mean, there's nothing that I do in my practice that I don't regularly question myself, or we don't question each other and say there must be a better way of doing this. This is the way we've always done it. But the best example I can give is the online space. And you and I did some research work when I was at Ideas Lab around this. And we just sort of said, well, let's think about this online space and think beyond the crude interpretation that were made with some of the early MOOCs in the first generation, and say, surely there are different ways in which we can engage people in a virtual space to what we engage them in face-to-face. And the best to keep going through that discussion, to be really specific about it, you know, the traditional webcasting space was simply a talking head on a screen with a couple of slides and people at the other end usually making coffee and pretending to be interested. And you're saying, well, what was that? That was didactic teacher delivery of content to an audience, which instead of being in the room, was sitting on screens and really not paying attention. And you thought about that, and you and I know have done, and many of our colleagues and many other people have come up with so many more creative ways in which you can engage people in that space. This is taking extreme, because this isn't saying what you do in a face-to-face classroom. This is saying in the virtual space, how can you connect with students to allow them to learn more powerfully as a result of having this environment? And yet most people aren't. They're just doing what they've always done. They're just standing in front of a camera and broadcasting out to an audience for an inert or passive response. I don't know why we aren't, well, the word we come back to is a word we use all the time. Why aren't we more curious about what this makes possible? You know, referring to Ideas Lab, as you know, our whole mantra for there for 3 years in the fortunate work I did with Richard Olson and Sophia, you know, we just asked ourselves, what's now possible? And I think as learning professionals, all of us should be inspired by that and should be curious about that and should want to know that there's so much more that we can do for our young kids.
Well, on that note, I'm wondering if it's possible to do 200 more newsletters, Bruce. I don't know. It's a big ask, but I'm looking forward to it. And this has been, it's just been really fun kind of reflecting on the past 3 years. And, you know, looking forward to another 3 years of, at least, of trying to engage people in this conversation and build the capacity for a higher bar change in schools. Just one thing, if you're still with us after almost an hour of kind of back and forth here, we are going to throw some of our best shifting conversations essays together in an ebook and also a paper book. You might have heard Bruce actually rustling around with some paper on his end down there in Melbourne. So we know that people still like to have those on paper, and we're going to be putting that out as well. But anyway, to those of you who have been longtime readers, we want to thank you so much for the support that you've given to our work, and we hope that you will let us know when we're getting it right and when we're not getting it right, because we want to engage in this conversation with all of you and lots more people as we move forward. So thanks a lot, Bruce. This has been really fun, both tonight and for the last few years, and looking forward to moving onward.
It's been a great journey. Thanks very much, everyone. We really appreciate the privilege of being able to work with you for this time.
Cheers.